Now let's turn to making some new memories and new discussions here tonight. Our keynote for the evening is entitled Perspectives on the Role of the Nation's Chief Legal Officer. To introduce the discussion and also offer a few remarks and a toast on his long history with the Florida Federalist Society, we are honored to be joined by Judge Greg Katsas, who sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, having been appointed by President Trump in 2017. Judge Katsas had a long and distinguished career as a lawyer and a public servant. Before joining the bench, during the Bush administration, he served as Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division and as Acting Associate Attorney General. During the Trump administration, he served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy Counsel to the President. As a practitioner, he was a very well-respected and accomplished appellate advocate, having argued 75 cases, including three at the U.S. Supreme Court. And most importantly for our purposes, Judge Katsas litigated many cases in Florida and has been a longtime honorary member of our Federalist Society group here in Florida. Please join me in welcoming Judge Katsas.
Thank you, Jesse. I'm just thrilled to be here tonight. This is my sixth Florida State Chapters Conference. I'm a proud member of the Florida Bar, and I've been actively involved in Florida FedSoc stuff since 2002, when the then fledgling Tallahassee chapter hosted me for what was their first ever Supreme Court roundup talk. The idea for this conference was hatched in 2014 at Siam Sushi, which is a Thai restaurant in Tallahassee. Jason Gonzalez, Jesse Panuccio, and Daniel Woodring were having dinner. They were mostly planning for the upcoming National Student Symposium at the University of Florida, but they thought, why not also have a statewide lawyers conference to establish a pipeline of prospective appointees for Governor Rick Scott, to create an expanded and single network of like-minded attorneys from Miami to Pensacola to share ideas and fellowship, and also to create a mechanism to educate those attorneys about core Federalist Society tenets like separation of powers, federalism, textualism, originalism, and all the rest. The leadership in the national office took some time to mull all of this over. So to get things going, Jason put down a $30,000 deposit of his own money at the Swan and Dolphin Resort, and then, in Jason's own words, forgot to tell his wife. Now, fortunately for Jason and for all of us here tonight, he had a very effective advocate in the National Office of FedSoc. Lisa Ezell persuaded her bosses to fund the conference. Jason got reimbursed. His marriage survived, and everything went ahead as planned. The first conference began on February 27, 2015. It was a rousing success. There were 225 people present, including at least 47 judges. The conference included an address by a young congressman named Ron DeSantis. It included panelisms on originalism and the separation of powers, which one might expect at any FedSoc event. But the most consequential panel was probably the very first one. It was titled Perspectives on the Florida Judicial Selection Process. Its speakers included the then sitting and three former general counsels to the governor of Florida. In short, this panel was about how to become a Florida judge. The Federalist Society went on to become that steady pipeline of talent for the Scott administration and then later for the DeSantis administration. Tonight here, we have an audience of some 700 attendees. The folks at that first panel 10 years ago obviously listened very well. Since included in our audience here, we now have over 100 judges, including a majority of the current Florida Supreme Court. Later conferences grew bigger and possibly even better. As you've heard and seen over the years, this conference has hosted Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch, Vice President Pence, Senators Rubio, Scott, and Lee, Governors Scott and DeSantis, and multiple Florida justices and judges, as well as multiple federal and state cabinet officers, among many others. This is the largest Federalist Society event besides NLC. I probably should have anticipated you would have heard that a bunch of times before I got up. But it has been since its inception. It's also spawned more than 20 statewide Federalist Society conferences and events in other states throughout the country, as well as the spinoff of the Florida State Conference for Young Lawyers, the future of this organization. It's been thrilling for me to watch this amazing network develop over the years and decades, and watch the distinguished service that so many of its members have rendered throughout the Florida state government. So please join me in a toast to the Federalist Society, the Florida Chapters Conference, and to Jason, Jesse, Daniel, and Lisa for making it all happen. Hear, hear. My other assignment tonight is to introduce our speakers tonight. They are all very well known to you, so I will be brief. John Ashcroft served as the 79th Attorney General of the United States from 2001 to 2005. Before that, he served as a United States Senator, Governor, Attorney General, and Auditor from the state of Missouri. And General Ashcroft hired me into the department in 2001. That was a career-changing move for me, and General, I'll always be grateful to you for that. Jeff Sessions served as the 84th Attorney General of the United States from 2017 to 2018. Before that, he served as Senator from Alabama. For 12 years, he served as the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama. He served as an AUSA in the same district, and by his account, one of his highest honors as a captain in the Army Reserve. Bill Barr served as the 85th Attorney General from 2019 to 2020, and also as the 77th Attorney General from 1991 to 1993, which makes him one of only two individuals to have served as the U.S. Attorney General twice. Before that, he served as Deputy Attorney General at DOJ, as the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, and as General Counsel first to GTE and then to Verizon. Our moderator tonight is Beth Williams. She is a member of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board and a lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School. From 2017 to 2021, she served as Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Policy under both General Sessions and General Barr. And in that capacity, she helped more than 230 judicial nominees through the confirmation process, including Judge Lagoa, Judge Tappar, Judge Mizell, and me. So Beth, a very special thank you for that service. Before that, she worked on a couple of other confirmations. She was special counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee and worked on the Supreme Court confirmations of Chief Justice John Roberts and Associate Justice Samuel Alito. Beth, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Two-timer. You should have known better.
Two-timer. That's right.
Where are you going?
I'll sit up there.
Yeah, go ahead. We'll sit. Get over here.
They put me on the left. Can't do that.
I think our mics are working. In case you didn't know.
Here I am in the center. I got in big trouble in a Senate committee for saying that there are three things you found in the center of the road: a yellow line, a dead skunk, and a moderate. And here I sit in the center.
Well, we're off to a good start. Well, good evening, everyone. I'm so happy to be here tonight, and thank you to Judge Katsas for that kind introduction. And I am delighted to be here with this panel. And I want to start just by saying, you know, people may not know this, but you all go way back. I know, Attorney General Ashcraft, you talked in your book about how Attorney General Barr advised you for your Senate confirmation hearing. And then you also talked about then-Senator Sessions in your book. And I'm going to quote this because I wrote it down. It said, "He is stronger than 10 acres of garlic when supporting his friends." So that was pretty evocative. So I'll start out by just asking, how much did you reach out to other former attorneys general in the job? I imagine there's a lot of weight on your shoulders. How much do you all reach out to each other? Attorney General Ashcroft?
Well, for me, I hadn't been a part of the department. These folks had a heritage in the Justice Department, so I needed a lot of help, and I did call on former attorneys general, individuals who occupied the office, some of whom I cherished for their advice for what they might be able to do to help me do a good job, and some that would help me warn me from some of the tragedies they endured. I got a lot of advice from good people. On a start, I just want to thank my wife, Janet, who's here with me. And I happened to have a Florida resident was my former chief of staff when I was both in the Senate and at Justice Department, David Ayers. And David, there are a group of you that knew about David because you were part of the department, but he is the best lawyer that the Wharton Business School ever produced. It's a delight. So I really felt that I needed, and I went through a confirmation process that was rigorous. That's where I kind of learned who your really friends are to help you. There were 4 days of challenge to my capacity and my character, and I really needed to make sure that I went to the department. I needed to do things that avoided errors, so I tried to call on individuals who had significant experience. And by the grace of God, I had all kinds of good people, from Paul Clement and Ted Olson and Larry Thompson and a wide variety of conservative people who came to my aid. Sometimes need itself is a way that good people are attracted. They see something. So I think people thought I needed help, and I did.
Well, Attorney General Sessions, you know, one of the challenges of being Attorney General is that you have crises all the time, and so it's kind of easy to manage by inbox. How did you decide to structure your day? How did you decide what your priorities were going to be going into the office?
Well, I had 12 years as a United States attorney and 2 as an assistant. Then I had 20 years on Judiciary Committee with oversight over Justice Department. And I was shocked to learn that the arguments that were bubbling up in the Department of Justice were the same ones when my boss, Bill Barr, was Attorney General under George H.W. Bush. It's the same old arguments, many of them. But we did have an additional complication. And so that was unusual. And so it's challenging. But yeah, so I came in the same day, and we had a number of agendas, but one of them was, because I'd been United States attorney, I knew how much of the work in this country gets done in U.S. Attorney's office in, you know, Miami and Middle District of Florida, and I knew people who'd done that. I'd done it. And so we spent a lot of time working to enhance the ability of where the real work of the department is done. It's the publicity workers in Washington, but the real work is out in the field.
Mm-hmm. And Attorney General Barr, you knew what the job entailed, and you came back and did it again anyway. So what made you come back a second time, and how was it different the second time you came back?
I had a brain fart. My wife of 50 years, Chris, now that you said it, General, I want to thank my wife for allowing me to do it. She advised me not to, but in a nutshell, he kept on saying that he wanted to talk to me, and people were encouraging me to do it, and I kept on trying to push other people out to do it. But at the end of the day, I felt, at least I was very concerned, there was a coup going on with the abuse of the Russiagate nonsense, and I felt someone had to go in there and deal with it, and that was probably the major reason. this idea of looking back through rosy-colored glasses and thinking, oh, gee, you know, H.W. Bush years, those were much different years, and, you know, things were much more professional. I mean, they went after H.W. Hammer and Tong. If you read my book, I regurgitate some of the horrible pseudo-scandals they tried to use to destroy his presidency and how tough it was. It wasn't quite as vicious, but, you know, it was pretty intense. What I found different was I came in the first time after 8 years of Ronald Reagan. I came in the second time after 8 years of Obama. And also the movement of the country and the legal profession more to the left. And in the first time around, I felt overall a more professional department. Yes, there were people who were Democrats and so forth, but there were many more of these people who were first and foremost professionals. At one point, I said, and I'm turning down an independent counsel thing that the media was bashing me during the election year to appoint an independent counsel, I said, you find any lawyer in the public integrity division, I give them leave right now. Publicly disagree with that decision. Say that they think that decision was wrong. And it was quiet. Now, that would not have happened in 2020 if I had done that. And so, you know, there's a lot more people embedded in the department who I felt were progressive partisan actors and who were affirmatively trying to sabotage the department, or at least the leadership of the department. The other thing I'll just say is that from day to day, the department's role had grown much more central in the government. You know, before, when I was with Bush, I went to National Security Council meetings and so forth, but one-on-ones in the Oval were like four, whereas it's almost four a day with Trump. So there's a lot more intensity to the job. And finally, I'll say, as I've said many times, 30 years after my first tour, things moved much faster on the outside and much slower within the department. And that was a bad combination because in the old days, a newspaper article would take a week to develop, whereas now things are popping up, you know, every second. And the people in the department were risk averse and didn't want to make decisions, and things moved very slowly.
Well, Attorney General Ashcroft, you talked about a "we don't do it that way" attitude too that you faced also in the department. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you did to push against it when you were Attorney General?
Well, I didn't have the. I certainly wasn't a "it's my way or the highway" Attorney General because I needed the help of the department, and gaining the confidence of the department was important, but it was not at the sacrifice of what we thought was the right thing to do. And the department can be a surprise. The day I was sworn in the middle of the punch and cookies that we were supposed to be consuming at the department celebrating my arrival, Louis Free came up to me and said, "I've got to talk to you." And I said, "Well, go right ahead." He said, "No, we've got to go to a skiff." And he told me about Robert Hansen and one of the most significant spy scandals. So you have to be prepared at a moment's notice. But I think the way that we get to the best outcomes is really modeled on what the Federalist Society does, and that is we debate the options. And I spent most of my time as Attorney General when I was in Washington inviting debates. Now, they were not long debates, but I think we usually spent about 20 or 30 minutes getting both sides in and hammering things out. And that's the way we wanted to operate. And we wanted to operate in such a way that we knew what we were doing, but we were confident in it, but it was not something that was predetermined. And I think that's a very good way for the department to have the right morale, for other people to feel like they have the ability to speak into the system and to come to the right conclusion whether or not they would prevail all the time. And obviously the Attorney General is going to feel like he has a very weighty part of that determination, but inviting the right kind of debate certainly helped me form the right decisions. I can't tell you how many times I went into a meeting thinking I knew the answer. It came out of the meeting either with substantial questions about the answer that I had previously thought was correct or with having changed my mind significantly. And I have to thank well-meaning members of the department for participating in those discussions.
So Attorney General Sessions, you focused a lot of your attention, your policy attention, on violent crime. And one of your very first policies was you made it a priority to the core principle that prosecutors should charge and pursue the most serious, readily provable offense, which seemed relatively non-controversial, but in fact met with a lot of resistance and controversy. Why did you pursue that policy, and how did you deal with the pushback?
Something was happening. I happened to be very present and participating in the early battles of Reagan against the rising crime. We'd had incredibly increased crime in the 60s and 70s, and for some reason I was interested in the crime. And it took about 12 years for crime to start declining. Homicides had tripled maybe in the 60s and 70s. People were putting burglar bars on their middle-class homes. Crime was the number one, really, election year for Reagan. It was not so much, nobody dreamed he would ever collapse the Soviet Union, but that was a huge issue. And so we made progress. But it's so slow, and it's hard to make progress on crime. It doesn't have, you pass a law, it's not going to improve next year. It's ways over periods of time. So we had gotten overconfident about the decline in crime. Homicides were down by half. Drug use had dropped by half. And the country was doing pretty darn well. So people then started saying, we've got too many people in jail. And the police are mean. And all of this stuff, and I could sense it. I knew it. And I warned, if we continue on this path, it's going to get worse. I sucked it up and said, it's not going to happen on this watch. Crime is not going to keep going up. Drug overdose deaths are not going to go up. And actually, it flattened out for 2 years until the George Floyd riots occurred. And 80% of law enforcement has stayed in local. So many of them collapsed, denigrated police, destroyed their morale, and we just had this threw away 40 years of improved crime enforcement. So we traveled around the country, and that policy just simply said what I think the honorable obligation of a prosecutor is. You should, if the federal law says you get 5 extra years for a crime if you carry a gun, it's almost unethical for the prosecutor not to charge it. And they didn't want to do that. This was, had already changed under the Obama administration. And so we were reversing their policies, and it resulted in a lot of feedback. And we had, you know, some of our libertarian, I won't say conservative, friends, they think that anybody you put in jail is an oppressive government. Sometimes.
Absolutely.
That's true. And but so that's kind of the way I felt about it. And I believe that had it not been for COVID and had it not been for the George Floyd riots, I believe this surge in crime might not have been as bad as it turned out.
I'd like to comment on the question you asked, General Ashcroft. To me, the fundamental dynamic within the department has been for a long time, and it's reaching a crescendo. There are two different visions of what the department's about. A lot of the embedded career, more political people, they view the department as an institution that sort of generates norms and common law in some, you know, invisible process. And that the Attorney General comes in from time to time just as a supervisor of the institution, but is bound by what the norms are. And the norms, guess what? Are set by these bureaucrats who have a political agenda. And they use all the tools, whether it be leaks or IG investigations or anything else, to try to control political direction from the top. Not political in the sense of partisan direction, but just the philosophical position of Republican leadership. In my view, the real point is that the Justice Department isn't carrying out just a statutory program created by Congress. The Attorney General was created first in 1789 to carry into effect and assist the president, seeing that the laws are faithfully executed. That is a constitutional power rooted in Article II. Yes, there are some statutory programs, but the office was created for that purpose. And all power in the department flows down through the Attorney General. The statute says all functions that exist in the department are directly vested in the Attorney General. And the thing that gives accountability to the department, that makes their decisions valid decisions within our system, is the fact that they are taken under the supervision of a politically accountable official. That's the fundamental dynamic, and it's a savage thing that goes on internally. One example of that was this idea that you don't investigate election fraud before an election is conclusively certified and over, because investigating election fraud could itself interfere in the election. I think that's insane. Yes, you have to be careful on a case-by-case basis and make sure that the remedy isn't, or you know, the cure isn't, well, whatever the expression is. Remedy's not worse than the disease. But and prudence is necessary. But the idea that that you are charged, the Justice Department is charged to prevent interference in an election by fraud, but we're not going to do it because we're worried in some abstract way that it's going to interfere in the election, is an absurdity. And if I had submitted to that, and I have been beaten up very badly because I said, that's ridiculous. We're going to do it on a case-by-case basis, and I'll decide when we do it. But if we had not done that, then after the election, when there were all these allegations of fraud, and the Department of Justice came in and said, well, we don't know what to think because we're not going to investigate it until after Biden's in office, I think the country would have devolved it potentially into some kind of civil war. And so I think that is the fundamental dynamic, and I think your question put the finger right on it. What kind of institution is it, and who ultimately has authority to make these decisions?
Well, with regard to that point, General Ashcroft, one of the things that we're seeing, I think, lately is obviously the Attorney General's primary duty is to enforce the law, but sometimes you've seen some people make the decision that they're not going to enforce entire classes of crimes, right? Not with regard, not just prosecutorial discretion, but I'm not going to enforce any of these types of crime. I think you call it the executive repealer. So what are your thoughts about that? Do you think that that's consistent with the Attorney General's duties?
Well, I think it's a very serious breach of the separation of powers when the executive branch decides to suspend the enforcement of the laws enacted by the Congress that represent the will of the people, and they should be enforced. We take an oath, whether you're the Attorney General or anybody in the department or virtually anywhere, to uphold the laws. And there is a difference between the case-by-case determination, which is discretion, prosecutorial discretion, and this phenomenon, which I refer to as an executive repealer, which is to say, well, I don't agree with this law, therefore I will not enforce this law. And I think one has to wonder whether that's not been true as it relates to the disaster at the southern border of the United States, where laws have not only been declared exempt from enforcement, shall we say, but there seems to be virtually a facilitation of the violations of the law, and based on the fact that that individuals in the justice system are in control of the prosecutorial process and have assured by conduct or either explicit assurance that the law will not be enforced. And in terms of a separation of power, when the executive decides it can virtually repeal laws by having a structure of non-enforcement, I think it's a very serious denial of the whole concept of government by the people and through their elected representatives, which should be guaranteed by the Constitution. And it raises, well, how is that remedied? It raises the ultimate oversight question in a republic, and that is the people have the right to say enough of that kind of disregard for our intended outcomes. We will get new people. But I think there is this literally a moral and legal responsibility to carry out the law that has been enacted. And this is maybe one of the most dramatic areas where this infects our culture right now is in the area of narcotics and marijuana. We have states that are passing laws that are authorizing, and this includes my own state, that are authorizing the use of a Schedule I substance. And it undermines the culture to the extent that it teaches people something very counterproductive about the law and the extent to which it ought to be respected. And part of the impetus for changing the law is the enforcement of laws as written. And if they are unacceptable to the public, then there is a dynamic that grows to get the law changed. But the idea that we just rely on executive repealer and poll taking, some people are favoring various constituencies so that they can ignore enforcement and reap the benefit of the vote of the constituencies, is a very dangerous threat to our democracy.
Well, I was going to actually ask Attorney General Sessions exactly about that, because you faced this the marijuana issue very early in your term, because remember, we only had two assistant attorneys general confirmed for a really long time because they were holding up the confirmations over the enforcement of marijuana laws. So what are your thoughts on the evolving nature of drug enforcement with the Department of Justice?
Well, I was there and participating in two big anti-drug citizens groups in Mobile for 10 years of my time, and I watched it pretty closely. Drug use, according to the University of Michigan study, dropped by 50% among high school seniors over about 10 years from when Reagan got elected and Just Say No started. Now I see San Francisco, Washington Post has an article, well, the problem is there's a cultural tolerance to drugs, and that's why overdose deaths have surged. Well, you really don't have to put anybody in jail, but you just can't accept drug use. Cato just wrote a piece very recently saying we wouldn't have a problem with fentanyl, we should just legalize it. Well, I don't think that's good. But as Attorney General, my issue that came to me was, could you allow banks to take money from state legalized marijuana groups when the federal law was that it was illegal? And so I said, I'm not doing that. And they were a vicious bunch. I mean, they were vicious. The marijuana crowd is really mean spirited.
And
President didn't want to make this a big issue, and neither anybody else. We weren't prosecuting, Bill. We didn't prosecute any marijuana cases. Give me a break. But I do think...
I prosecuted.
Well, I guess that's true.
I mean, Gonzalez versus Raich, it was argued in December. Unfortunately, Gonzalez came in February. It was decided in June, and so his name went on it instead of mine.
We did not routinely prosecute small amounts of marijuana. That's just a fact, and the prison has nobody in it for very small amounts of marijuana. But whatever people decide about the legalization, I'm not for it, but people can decide, but we don't need to suggest that it's a healthy substance, and you're going to get healthier the more you use it.
I want to add something and I don't mean to monopolize, but the group of U.S. attorneys, the executive council, came in and said they didn't want to be prosecuting any marijuana cases below something like 50 pounds. And I said, well, that's interesting. I want each of you to make sure that at least once a year you publish, you prosecute something that's at the 5-pound or the more modest level. I said, I do not want to announce or let it be known that there's a policy which will result in the repackaging of all marijuana shipments, so they'll be all less than 50 pounds, and it'll be a way of promoting the use and transmission and importation of marijuana in the culture. And I was able, I think I got reasonable cooperation, but you have to understand that the culture has marched a long way since I was, I may look like a tired soldier because I'm old, which is, I am. And so it's different in those days, but I frankly said, it may not be the way you would do it in the past to take a vote from U.S. attorneys, but I don't think we're in a position to signal a legalization of marijuana at certain levels of packaging, which would result in a substantial increase in the distribution of what I consider to be a threatening. But whether it's a threatening or noxious substance is not important to me. Is against the law, the laws of the United States of America. And that was important to me.
Beth, I was going to say, on the question of...
Jeff, could I just jump in here for a sec? I think on many fronts, the law is being ignored, and respect for the rule of law is steadily eroding, and you can see that across the board in state and federal government. An example of it is the death penalty.
It's what?
The death penalty.
Oh, yeah.
The Attorney General is charged with carrying out the sentence of the court. And that's why the Bureau of Prisons is on the Department of Justice. And if someone gets sentenced to 15 years, the Attorney General does not have the prerogative of saying, gee, I think that was harsh. I'm only going to keep him in prison for 5 years. You carry out the sentence of the court. We have the death penalty on the books. And after the death after a trial, the jury has decided it. It's been reviewed ad nauseum for 10, 15 years. The time comes to carry out the sentence. So when I see these liberals, including the current Attorney General, who is a nice guy and everything, but you know, they talk about the rule of law, but they're not carrying out the law. One of the things we decided the time had come to carry out the federal law on the death penalty. And we spared, you know, it took a lot of effort because, you know, people, you can never do it. I mean, they'll just litigate it to death and so forth. And we mobilized the litigators in the department. And we picked out people who had been on death row for a long time with the most heinous crimes against little kids and so forth. And we set 13 people for execution. And I thought we might get a handful of them actually accomplished. But we got all 13. And to me, it just shows that if there's the will, and by the way, you know, the world did not come to an end.
Yeah.
Okay. And every time an execution was performed, we put out the statement as to what they did. And the law can be enforced. It just takes the will to do it.
I want to talk a little bit about terrorism because Attorney General Ashcroft, September 11th very much shaped your term as Attorney General, which is something obviously that you couldn't know about at the time you took office. At the end of your term, the Wall Street Journal opined that Mr. Ashcroft's signature achievement is helping tear down the pre-Patriot Act wall that prevented communication between intelligence agents and criminal investigators. This wall, Mr. Ashcroft told the 9/11 Commission, meant the old national intelligence system in place on September 11th was destined to fail. We just had Director Wray come and say that the threat of terrorism has never been as high as it is now since September 11th. What do you think the government should be doing in light of that warning?
Well, I think it should be learning everything it can to prevent, but it needs to learn in ways that are consistent with the law. And one of the shocking things about the last few years is that the justice system has been willing to ignore the law in pursuing its gathering of intelligence that theoretically was designed to prevent terrorism. I think it's pretty clear that there have been admissions in the FBI that people fraudulently altered the record of interviews and the like, and individuals, Americans who were under surveillance, were maligned inappropriately. The fact of the surveillance was inappropriately disclosed. That's sort of outing in this information. I have been concerned that we don't want to lose our ability to gather information. It is the best friend of prevention, but it cannot be gathered at the expense of American liberties and the privacy of Americans. So I think there are about a half dozen things that ought to be done that I think might be considered. Maybe they shouldn't be done. One, the FISA court operates based on an ex parte proceeding. You can't tell a person, we're going to tap your phone and we're having an adjudication about whether you're an appropriate target. Because in the deadly game of terror, when the hiders know where the seekers are going to look, they don't stay there anymore. I mean, that's just... So it may be that there should be some adjustments so that at least when Americans are to be the target, there ought to be something like a guardian ad litem system where someone argues in favor of the person if there is exculpatory information that means they shouldn't be surveilled. A second thing that I think would be very important would be that, and we owe this to the FISA court, I believe, that if there is exculpatory information that would militate against tapping the phone, it should be provided to the court for its decision. It's sort of the Brady law that you have to provide relevant information to the defendant in the criminal matter, and I don't know that criminals should have superior rights than people who are subject of potential surveilling. Then if there is a desire to make public the fact that someone had been surveilled, I think the department ought to have to go back to the FISA court and justify that. I think none of us would like the idea made public that we were somehow being surveilled as potential terrorists, and without, especially if there were no outcome that resulted in any action necessary to be taken. I also have some reservations now about an old, age-old practice of the department, the FBI, to operate on the basis of written reports of interviews and interrogations. We have the ability to, and do require law enforcement in so many instances, to record with body cameras and the like, things that are being undertaken, investigations and encounters with suspects. But I don't know if there's some way for us to make sure that where possible, there be actual recordings of things. The idea of someone's recollections a day later and conclusions being written up, no matter how carefully, leads me to some diminished level of confidence that justice might be done. The last thing, one other thing. I think when I left office as Attorney General, there was a very limited group of individuals that was allowed to encounter the raw data from surveillances. And I think that was expanded by a factor of about 400%, you know, went from about 5 people to about 25 people. And we all know that in Washington, 3 people can keep a secret as long as 2 of them are dead, you know. It just, and having widespread awareness of surveillances is a threat to the integrity and privacy of American citizens. I think we need to be able to convince America again that the system is not subject to manipulation, especially against individuals who are American citizens and who are active politically. I spoke at a conference of the,
Let me turn to Attorney General Barr on this, because you've dealt with this too, with reining in the FBI, and you issued certain memos about that, but you also started your career in intelligence. So do you think, you know, Section 702, which is one of the nation's, you know, most important authorities, should be reauthorized, and how do we do that in a responsible way?
Yeah, I definitely think it should be reauthorized. I think a lot of the problems in the counterterrorism intelligence collection and analysis is really the incompetence, organizational and individual incompetence in these agencies, especially the FBI. It's a lot of stupidity, it's a lot of mistakes being made, and it's the failure of discipline. If someone breaks the rules and you know, taps into a database where they shouldn't have, they have to be fired. There's a general breakdown of discipline within the FBI. When I went into the CIA, and it was the same at the FBI, you could be fired like that. Boom, no questions asked. You had no real rights. And now, you know, no one will discipline anybody in the FBI. So there's lack of institutional discipline, but I think the basic structure is right. And one of the problems is, this stuff is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment when it's collected. I think a lot of the abuses should be in the agencies where people are sort of checking on their girlfriends and stuff like that. That has to be dealt with more harshly, and it has to be dealt with by auditing internally and constant review. But what I don't like is people sitting around thinking, you know, focused on that and not looking at what the real issue is. The real issue is that virtually everything is now digitalized. All evidence is essentially digital. All our interactions with everything is now captured in a digital record. And the government has started the process, especially under this administration, of trying to set up these centralized databases so they can be pinged if and when there's a reason to investigate. So, for example, there is this proposal, you probably have never heard of it, called the CAT proposal from the SEC. It's actually been adopted and it's being implemented. Every single trade in a security and every account that has securities will be in a real-time database under the control of the government, accessed by not only the SEC, but every exchange in the country and dozens of these private groups like FINRA and the rest of them that, you know, support the SEC and the financial enforcement mechanisms, with over 5,000 people getting access to this. Now, the FBI can't get it straight getting access to stuff. This is a horrible thing, and furthermore, nation states like China and Russia will be able to hack these like that. So everyone's financial data. You say, well, why are you doing that? Don't you need some kind of predicate to go out and get this information? Well, this will help us if and when we have to investigate. But then think about where that takes us. Our cars put out telemetry. The manufacturers have that telemetry. You set up a fundamental data, you know, set up a centralized database where all that telemetry goes. So if they need to know where someone has been, this is the real threat to civil liberties, what's going on now. And the congressmen, Republican and Democrat, like to blow, you know, a lot of hot air about 702, which are foreign communications that are being intercepted, and ignoring what's happening out there that will have much more practical impact on the privacy of the American people.
Beth, I would say that I agree with that, and AI represents an additional threat, and I'm glad you're there protecting us on the commission. I did come to sense, and I believe this is not an exaggeration, that second, third level staffers were making decisions and telling people further up what they wanted them to know, and they didn't trust politically appointed leaders accountable to the people. They were going to protect American security. They were going to advance the interest, and I think that I began to sense that was dangerous. I never really got to the bottom of it, but I know that CIA and DNI and Department of Justice and Department of Defense staffers were talking all the time about matters that it never really got up to higher echelon people sometimes. And then the discipline bill, as you mentioned, and the accuracy of the FISA complaints, even though they were sworn to and all, I think facts show now that they weren't accurate enough. They didn't meet the standards that should have been met, and it's dangerous. So I do think that somehow the more, I think you got to have leaders who insist that this be done right, because it can be lost. And danger out there is real. Good intelligence is important. We have to have secrets as a nation, but somebody needs to be in a position to review it. And John, you mentioned some of the things that could be done, and I might not have supported that 15 years ago, but I think I might now a lot more than I was thinking about.
Well, let me change the topic a little bit to one thing that was important with all of your terms as Attorney General, which is religious liberty. And for all three of you, support of religious liberty was a central component of your work as Attorney General. And Attorney General Sessions, you actually formed the Religious Liberty Task Force and made the great decision of making Jesse Panuccio one of the co-heads of it. And so, and I was the other co-head, but why don't you talk a little bit about,
why Jesse Panuccio and Beth to head that up. They created a passionate staff. The president asked us to, and he met with religious leaders, and they expressed concerns about it. And so I think that's the way the political process works. citizens concerned raise an issue with the president. He says, let's do something about it. He sends it to the appropriate agency, and we got some people who believed in it and advanced it. We talked with lawyers around the country who've dealt with cases, and they've seen liberties being denied in an improper way. So that was not required, didn't require Congress, but it set the standard for the federal government that no federal agency could violate the things that you wrote. I was really proud of it. I think it was constitutionally carefully written, legally sound in every way, could be defended in any court, but it definitely relieved a lot of concerns about in our community of our religious leaders about what had been happening.
Yeah, and Attorney General Barr, you dealt with this during the COVID pandemic especially, because we saw churches being shut down, but bars were able to be open. How did you approach religious liberties, Attorney General?
Well, I think the COVID episode really showed the latent prejudice against religion in many sectors, and they were treated worse than just about anybody else during COVID, the churches and so forth. And I think that shows some of the animus that exists, that mobilizes some of the left administrations to go after religion. In my view, it's nothing more important, because at the end of it, we have a system where no one's required to be religious. People can believe what they want to believe. But as was quoted in the benediction at the beginning, our system would collapse without religion, a religious foundation among the people. Enough people have to have that. And I think the basic crisis of the West generally, and the United States specifically, is the loss of that foundation and the fact that there is nothing else that can supply it. And I think virtually every single trouble we have, other than perhaps foreign policy, ultimately is rooted in this problem. Now, the government can't go and push religion. But that's not what's happening today. Government policies are set to burden religion and suppress it. And what's happening in our public school systems is an outrage, because it involves the government doing something they don't have the power to do. But everyone since 1830s in the creation of the public school system, which were originally created and explicitly to support religion as essential to an education. People forget that. But they basically are now in the business of affirmatively teaching isms, ideology, not reading, writing, arithmetic, not how the American government works, not even the presuppositions of the capitalist system and so forth. They're teaching blind ideology. Where does the government get the power to teach children what to believe like that? I don't think they have it. And I think they're trying to create an alternative to religion. And I think that's a general, a fundamental threat to our country.
And Attorney General Ashcraft, I want to give you an opportunity to weigh on this too. In 1993, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed nearly unanimously. I think very few people think that would probably pass with the same majorities today. What is your sense? Do you think that religious liberties are stronger protected now than they were then?
No, I don't. I think that I endorse totally what Attorney General Barr has said. I think it is fundamentally important to our country that democracy or republics survive based on the morals of people and the assertion that there is no ascertainable truth, that there are no ascertainable rules, which is part of the devaluation of religion, is very dangerous. And then I think whether it's understood improperly or not, when you have the FBI apparently identifying Catholics as being subversive and then in some way refusing to acknowledge what they had done, either covering that up or... I've been watching snippets of Director Ray on television, and he says he regrets it, but they can't find the records of what they had done, because you're wondering whether the record keeping is that sloppy or whether they just don't want to confess to the Congress where they are. When you get that kind of assault on, and you know, we mean freedom. We don't mean sectarianism, I think, when we're speaking. Shortly after 9/11, it was my responsibility to go to a number of minority religious communities in this country and assure them, because we had individuals who were like people part of the Sikh faith who were being assaulted, discriminated against. We had to take a strong stand to the extent of prosecuting individuals who threatened them and assuring them that we are in favor of people having freedom of religion. I don't see that as being the case. There is this sort of, I have to say, anti-Christian bias. And then, of course, in the last several months since October, whether it's the 5th or 6th, there appears to be an anti-Judeo-Christian bias that's broadened that is very threatening and unsettling in this country. And I think we have had inadequate assurance that the business of government is to protect religious freedom. And in the earliest days of our government, it was to promote religion, not promote sectarianism, but to say we need, and John Adams' quote is clear about that. Witherspoon, who was the president of Princeton, wrote extensively on this, and he schooled I don't know how many presidents of the United States early on that we should speak well of the responsibility of the culture to have an awareness of ultimate fundamental morality and character in religious terms. But that's been lost, and it's a serious crisis for the country. And I hope we can regain an understanding of what's the right balance here. It's not to promote one sect or religion over another, but to concede that a religious people who believes in the ultimate existence of truth and evil and decency and goodness is far more likely to survive as a culture than people who believe that truth is whatever you want it to be.
Want to respond, Attorney General Sessions?
I think John is right about that. We've talked about it personally a number of times. The whole republic is founded on debate, free speech, to try to figure out what the truth is. But in this modern age of ideological secular left progressives, they don't believe in the idea of objective truth. Yeah. It's all power, which is more akin to the Marxist ideology. The only thing counts is what advances the revolution. So I think it is hard for us to maintain the republic that we've known if we have a more secular ideological foundation instead of the religious foundation that we founded. I really worry about that, and hopefully we can figure out a way to avoid even more danger. I've spent a lot of my time recently worrying about and talking to people about higher education, teaching history, teaching civics, and I find that so many of the teachers have been not taught any of the great principles of history that reveal how marvelous the American Republic was when it was founded, how liberal, how advanced it was when it was founded. And I got to tell you, one critic rightly said, college professors are teaching young teenagers how to be activists. They need to be teaching them how to think. They need to be teaching them facts. And maybe then they will be able to to become a really wise leader in the future. So excuse me, Matt, but thank you.
No, no problem. And Attorney General Barr.
This is the way I think of it. You know, you all, being lawyers, are familiar with the idea of teleology, telos. What's the target at which something is aimed? And what's the, where's the arrow shot? And the fundamental question confronting humanity is, what's our end? What's our objective? What's the meaning? And there are two different approaches. One is that the telos, the end of each of us, is a transcendental end and an individual end. It's the purpose and meaning and direction of our own lives. The other is that the telos of the human race is a collective one. It is not transcendent. It's something that will be achieved in the here and now through the organization of society, and we will get to our final salvation as a collective, the perfection of the collective. Now, if you believe that everyone can go to hell in their own way, the way we, the way that essentially the Anglo-American tradition was, then the fact that someone disagrees with you, at the end of the day, isn't that important, because we're living our own lives. But if you are a collectivist and believe that the salvation of man and the meaning of your life and the place that you have in the universe as this agent of this collective movement is threatened by resistance, then that person becomes a mortal threat and an enemy. And that is where all the venom, I think, in our political system is emerging from. It is the dichotomy between the Anglo-American tradition and the French Revolution totalitarian collectivist secular vision. And I'm afraid that the Democratic Party has moved outside the tent, and their center of gravity is no longer within the Anglo-American political tradition, and it's become essentially a collectivist revolutionary movement that can brook no opposition.
Well, I want to ask a question now that I think a lot of people in the room are always very curious about, which is judicial selection. So very often people are surprised that across administrations, the Department of Justice plays a fairly large role in helping with judicial selection and in helping judges to get confirmed. So, and this is partly because the Attorney General is a legal advisor to the President in his official role, and partly a question of manpower. DOJ just has more folks around who can help with the work. So, Attorney General Sessions, what was your approach to judicial selection, and how did it work with the department?
Well, it was so important to me. And, well, let me just say something first. In my experience in political life, I can think of no organization who had a more clear goal than the Federalist Society, and he was more successful in achieving it than the Federalist Society. It's amazing to me. I can remember as a young prosecutor appointed by the Nixon administration, and Rehnquist was the only one, you know. And I don't even think he was an originalist. He was a great justice. But so it looked hopeless. But by raising this issue up politically, the people on the side of judges who serve the law, not make law, that is politically a winning argument if you make it clearly. I made it hundreds of times on the floor of the Senate. So I'm proud of what you've done, and without this society and the leadership it's had, I'm telling you, we wouldn't have six originalists on the Supreme Court of the United States. It's unbelievable to me. So congratulations. So what did we do? Well, we turned it over to Beth. Beth is the Office of Legal Policy, and we would find names sometimes. Or the senators would bring forward names. They would do background checks on them. They would dig into their records before nominations were made, and they would prepare them the testimony. Y'all did that hundreds and hundreds of times, meeting with the White House counsel, Don McGahn, who was really good on all this, too. And Beth was in on all the interviews of every candidate with that small group. And I just think it was the best group of judges ever been nominated. I really loved Reagan judges. I thought they were great. Bush judges were great. But I really think the Trump judges were maybe superior. I think so. So I thought it was a good process. We had very little disagreements. I was at the meeting. I set up the meeting. Had Leonard Leo and Jim DeMint, who was then at Heritage, and Newt Gingrich was there. When Trump said, "Why don't I just have a list of 10 names?" I think I was the only senator at that point, and maybe one House member that endorsed, two House members endorsed Trump. And Leonard said, yeah, I like this. Jim DeMint said, yes. They were huddling over there. And anyway, the president honored his commitment to listen to Federalist Society and other conservative groups before he made his nominations to judges. And he delivered throughout his whole term, so far as I can see. So I think that was good.
Attorney General Barr, how did you work it? And do you think the Attorney General should help advise the president?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the great progress has been made is not only the institution that's been built, like the Federalist Society, but it's been the consciousness of how central it is to have a strong judiciary. You know, even during the Reagan and H.W. Bush administrations, you know, there was lip service paid to it and some understanding of it, but people were willing to allow the system to be jerked around because of, you know, short-term political trade-offs and exigencies and so forth, and you know, defer very heavily to senators and so forth. And gradually we've gotten to a much more disciplined system, but so has the other side. And it's not just presidential elections, it's congressional elections, because I think, well, the Trump administration deserves tremendous credit, and President Trump himself deserves credit for sticking with the program. The fact is, Mitch McConnell, who catches a lot of crap, he was indispensable to bringing this around, starting with him blocking the substitute for Scalia. And it was, frankly, the discipline of the Republican senators with a very narrow majority that got us where we needed to be. So it's critical. Presidential elections are very important, but trying to win a working majority in the House and Senate and really accomplishing some significant things is, to me, critical at this juncture.
Attorney General Ashcroft, I'll ask you, I think, our final question, which is, who should be serving as Attorney General? It's been said that the best kind of person to serve as Attorney General in these difficult times is somebody who is very accomplished and doesn't need another job. And in fact, one of my favorite lines from Attorney General Barr's confirmation hearing is when he told the Senate Judiciary Committee, I don't need this title, which was fantastic. So Attorney General Ashcroft, who do you think should be serving as Attorney General? And you can feel free to nominate someone, too, if you have a name.
You know, I don't know that there is an ability to say that you have a specific profile that fits all the needs and all the circumstances. I'd like to believe I was the right person at that time, but I don't know that my profile would fit every time, and maybe that's an arrogant position of mine that I was the right person to be there. I happen to have had a lot different I came to the job with a different set of experiences, having been a state official for a long time. But, you know, and I've appointed a lot of judges, and I think I appointed over 200 of them when I was governor. But I think it's important to be prepared in advance. Let me just move to another. I think, and to know if the administration can be understanding of what the resources are in advance and to put them in place and to sort of not have the situation of indecision and to suggest that there would be lots of new other avenues and ideas. I think if we know who we need, who we want, have a clear understanding with the right research done, the right criterion established, be aware of the likelihood of even unlikely things transpiring, because health crises in the court, for example, can make a difference. I think that's important, so that we know what we want to do. And Jeff is entirely correct. No organization has been better at providing the sort of minor leagues and the vetting and the development of awareness of individuals and their persistent character. We've seen people who held themselves out to be of one stripe or another and ascend to the court, and all of a sudden the president's saying, who's that I appointed? You know, I think the more involvement we have with groups like the Federalist Society, the more likely we are to have an accurate understanding of what we're doing and to avoid making states mistakes, because the mistakes tend to live a long time. And I don't wish the death of anybody, but as long as I've got to wish people long life, I would prefer it to be the right folks.
Beth, on your question about, so I'm at a meeting toward the end of my tenure, and Trump was after me again, I think. So about 10 or 12 lawyers, they would brief me on the subject, and they all left, and this young woman lawyer came back and said, we were just talking, Mr. Attorney General, and we decided it was really great to have an Attorney General who doesn't have a future. And I'm thinking, maybe she meant is not worried about their future, but young lawyers were often put, I saw in this administration, in some very difficult positions. They came from firms that were very hostile to the Trump administration. Many of them just showed tremendous courage. They didn't know what their future would be like. But I was at the point I didn't give a dadgum, you know. We made our decision. We're going to try to do the right thing and see what. But I do think that it is a tough, lonely job sometimes. And these two have the character and the courage to try to do the right thing. And one more thing. There is a little bit of a discussion out there that, well, we're too nice. When we're in, we obey the law. And when they're in, they don't obey the law. And that we might be at a point where we've got to cross the Rubicon. Mm-mm. And I was real pleased. I hadn't been talking in the media. I wanted to talk about that, but Bill hammered that really hard. How are you going to improve the rule of law by violating the law yourself? You know, if you're not happy with politicalization of law, should you then respond by politicizing the law? So this is the future of the republic's at stake, and I think we've got to keep our poise. We need to win elections. Like, it took a long time, but the reverse Roe, legally and properly, people's voices were eventually heard. So I just would warn that we better be careful not to be seduced by voices that we can fix things by violating the rules ourselves.
Yeah.
Attorney General Barr, any final thoughts?
I think Jeff said pretty much what I was going to say, which is, to me, nowadays, the problem I see is that the politics of personal destruction and canceling are such. I felt bad for the people working in the department with me, political appointees in their 40s and 50s and so forth, because when they made a decision and it got out they were the decision maker, it could destroy their entire career. Not because the decision was a bad decision, but because of the politics. And so I used to say that I held the job of Attorney General at the two times where anyone should hold that job, either too young to understand the risk or too old to care. And nowadays, I think you really have to be too old to care. You really can't. You need people who just don't give a damn about what the consequences are, because they have to provide air cover for their subordinates nowadays. So the other thing is all this stuff about who does the Attorney General work for. Let there be no mistake about it. The Attorney General was part of the President's cabinet and carries out the president's powers into effect. And it shouldn't be any secret over the fact that, you know, they are part of an administration that has a political agenda. And I think the Attorney General should be supportive of that agenda and do everything they can to make to achieve it and to help the president, frankly, get reelected if necessary. But at the end of the, you know, at the end of the day, you have your ultimate duty to the Constitution of the United States and the law. And ultimately, you need people who understand that they're not separate, they're not independent of the president, but they have to have enough nuance and understanding to know that at some point, especially with a president who may think it's time for tit for tat, that they have to have the ability to say, no, absolutely not. And you know, I felt there was a point in time where I was concerned that we were heading to a situation where there would not be a peaceful transfer of power, and that the mere, you know, allegation by one side without any evidence of the incumbent administration that the election was stolen would be enough to stay in power. And I thought, we can't go down that path. We can't go down that path, especially, you know, because most of this stuff that was being thrown out was ridiculous. So I felt the department and the Attorney General, we just had no choice but to do what we did.
I agree, but the bill that's written about this, I think in your first term about the unified executive, we've got one elected executive. And we're all, I supported the Trump agenda. I knew what the Trump agenda was before he announced it. And so I believed in trying to help him be successful. But you don't help the president if you acquiesce in something that's improper. So a lot of people in the department do seem to feel that they're like some judge or something, that they're independent of the executive branch, of which they're just a cog in the machine.
Right.
Well, this was really wonderful, and thank you so much for this discussion, and thank you, most of all, all of you, for your service as Attorneys General. Thank you.